Committee will now come to order. It is now 3:20 p.m. Thursday, March 5th, 2026 in Davis 106. Members present are Representatives Schwanke, Ruffridge, Mears, Gray, Prox, and myself, Representative Mina. Chair, let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Staffing the committee today, we have Andrew Giannotti, our Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, Zach Lawhorn, our LAO moderator, and Katie Giorgio, my committee aide. If you need anything during the meeting, please don't hesitate to get her attention. We are returning to House Joint Resolution 32 that is first on our agenda today, sponsored by our Committee on the Rural Health Transformation Program.
Chair Mina, I move that the Health and Social Services Committee adopt the draft committee substitute for HJR 32 work order number 34-LS1498/I as a working document.
I will object for purposes of discussion. Would Ms. Lori Winghire please come to the presenter's table and walk us through the changes in version I?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Lori Winghire. I'm the healthcare liaison for the legislature. As respects version A to version I, on version A, page one, the title has been amended to reflect the changes throughout the document. In lines one and two, the words "and articulating priorities for the program" have been deleted. Lines five through seven, beginning with "and expressing legislative intent," have been deleted. Page two, lines three through six, have been deleted. 26 through 20, or whatever, have been deleted. Let me get my numbers better than that. Lines three, or page three, lines five through 26 have been deleted. And I'll go back to correct whatever I didn't type correctly. On page two, lines three through six have been deleted. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure what we did. Let me go back one more time.
Brief at ease.
My apologies, Madam Chair.
Back on the record, Ms. Winghire.
Sorry, my apologies. 7 through 26 have been deleted. And then on the following page, lines 3, 5 through 26 have been deleted. But in its place, on version I, you will see lines 24 and 26 have been added. So the resolution now reads, "Further resolved that the Alaska State Legislature wishes to signal its strong commitments to the Rural Health Transformation Program and to establish clear priorities to guide program implementation," and "be it," with the new language, "further resolved that the Alaska State Legislature supports flexibility in the Rural Health Transformation Program's criterion timeline to maximize investment in healthcare facility infrastructure and workforce development," and "be it." The resolution continues. Those are the changes, Madam.
Thank you, Ms. Winghire. Before I remove my objection to adopting the committee substitute, is there any further discussion on the changes? Representative Gray.
I appreciate that it's much shorter, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Concision is key.
I would say the same. Thank you for those who worked on this.
Thank you. And thank you to the committee members for your feedback on the resolution and for making it better and straight to the point. I am now going to remove my objection to adopting the CS. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS? Seeing none, the CS has been adopted. We will now continue public testimony on House Joint Resolution 32. First off, is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online who wishes to testify? Seeing no more individuals wishing to testify, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Is there any further discussion on HJR 32? I would now entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Sorry. Rep. Mina, Chair Mina, I move House Joint Resolution 32, Work Order 34-LS1498/I from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Joint Resolution 32 passes from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the committee report. Back on the record, now we return to our second item on the agenda, House Bill 232, Minor Mental Health Age of Consent by Representative Gray. We received no amendments for this bill. We have two invited testifiers today, Heather Ireland, Executive Director of Anchorage School-Based Health Centers, and Michael Carson, My House North Pole. We will now open up the bill for public testimony. First off, is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online who wishes to testify? And it looks like I have Trevor Storrs, President and CEO with Alaska Children's Trust.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Trevor Storrs, President and CEO of the Alaska Children's Trust. Today, I'm testifying in support of House Bill 232, which would allow 16 and 17-year-olds the ability to provide self-consent to receive up to 5 behavioral health treatment sessions. At the Trust, we believe in a future where Alaska's children, youth, and families have the knowledge, skills, supports, and resources they need to thrive. Achieving this vision means ensuring that the next generation of parents, especially those navigating adversity, has access to timely behavioral health support before challenges escalate into crisis or harm, and ensure they are equipped with the tools and protective factors they need as they enter adulthood and become parents themselves. According to Kids Count, 2 out of every 5 high school students in Alaska report feeling persistently sad or hopeless for an extended period during the previous year, a nearly 60% increase since 2009. This number has moved steadily upward, increasing almost 60% in the past decade. Attempted suicide rates amongst high school students in Alaska have generally increased over the years, highlighting the urgent need to remove barriers to mental health services. HB 232 creates a critical path for 16, 17-year-olds to access behavioral health services in situations where seeking parental consent may be unsafe, unrealistic, or an act as a barrier to care. Alaska's youth experience a wide range of family circumstances, including exposure to trauma, substance misuse, domestic violence, neglect, or housing instability. In these situations, the inability to access early support can compound harm. This bill carefully balances the importance of parental involvement in treatment while also recognizing that limited short-term access to care can be life-saving for some youth. Importantly, this bill is intentionally limited in scope. It does not allow for prescription of meds, nor does it remove parents from the broader behavioral health system. It does provide a narrow, preventative opportunity for early intervention. From a prevention standpoint, this bill is especially important. Research consistently shows that unaddressed mental health needs during adolescence increase the risk of substance misuse, unsafe coping behaviors, family conflict, and future involvement in systems designed to respond after harm has occurred. House Bill 232 reflects a balanced approach that respects the role of parents and prioritizes prevention, early intervention, and youth well-being. By expanding access to behavioral health services, this bill strengthens Alaska's commitment to primary prevention. We encourage your support of HB 232, and thank you for this opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Storrs, for your testimony. Next, we have Kathleen Wittemeyer with the Deputy Director of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, calling in from Seattle, Washington. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Wiedemeyer. I'm with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, a psychiatric watchdog group. HB 232 creates a significant shift in the balance from parental authority to state-authorized behavioral health intervention for minors. The bill authorizes 16 and 17-year-olds to receive up to 5 outpatient mental health sessions without parental consent, and it authorizes providers to continue treatment beyond those 5 sessions if they determine that involving a parent would be detrimental to the minor. The bill allows early diagnostic impressions and referrals to occur without parental knowledge. Even though medication cannot be prescribed without parental consent, the initial framing of a young person's challenges, whether as depression, trauma, or another condition, can shape their identity and future treatment trajectory before parents are even aware that an evaluation has taken place. The bill removes parents' ability to intervene in their child's treatment, offering no way to contest or change services. It prioritizes the minor's choice without clarifying whether this is based on input from teachers, counselors, or mental health providers. The requirements and standards for informed consent by the student are not specified. Finally, the detrimental to the minor exception gives providers broad discretion to continue treatment indefinitely without parental involvement. Although the bill requires periodic review, the standard remains subjective and rests solely with the provider, not with the family. I'm going to quote here, children have a right to thrive, to develop in a holistic way to their full potential and enjoy good physical and mental health in a sustainable world. It is crucial that investments are made to provide the nutritional, educational, and societal resources for healthy development. And that is from Danis Pyrrhus, MD, Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and former UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights to Health. Lowering the age of consent delays or removes informed consent and parental involvement, which are fundamental to the ethical treatment of minors. This change not only undermines parents' rights to guide their children's health care decisions, but also places adolescents at risk of long-term psychiatric treatment without adequate oversight. Parental involvement is essential for supporting children's well-being during such interventions. Please vote no on HB 232 as written. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wiedemeyer, for your testimony. Seeing no more individuals wishing to testify, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Is there any further discussion on House Bill 232? Representative Prax?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Brief at ease. Back on the record, my apologies. We're going to go backwards a little bit and go to our invited testifier. We did hear from Ms. Heather Ireland with Anchorage School-Based Health Centers, the last hearing that we had on this bill. And so I would now like to invite Mr. Michael Carson, Vice President and Recovery Specialist with My House, to begin your testimony.
Thank you and good afternoon. My name is Michael Carson. I am the Vice President and recovery specialist at My House in the Valley. We service a homeless youth. And we obviously know that our youth are in a mental health crisis. According to the YBRS results, we have 43% of students reporting feeling sad and hopeless for 2 weeks straight, and then disengaging in regular activities. We have 22% of students reporting having feelings and ideas around suicide, and 19% have attempted once or twice. My House is interested in supporting HB 232, specifically sections 1 and 2 regarding unaccompanied youth. We have youth that are coming in that are 16, 17-year-olds that have parents that have left the state or abandon them. Just saying that is depressing. We are needing the opportunity for those youth to be able to seek mental health services and be able to deal with those strong emotions. So again, we are asking for specifically Section 1 and Section 2 unaccompanied youth being able to access mental health counseling. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Carson, for your testimony. Now I would like to move to invite if there's any further discussion on House Bill 232. Representative Prox, I believe you wanted to speak.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I am concerned. The focus has been on youth, which is understandable, but we haven't given enough consideration to the probably underlying problem of communications or whatever with the parents. And I think that is vital for a long-term solution to this problem. And I don't know how to address that, but we haven't addressed that.
Thank you. I will note that in the bill, it allows for minors to participate in up to 5 counseling sessions without parental involvement. And so if a child hits their 6th session, that is when parents will have to be involved. So I do see that mechanism there, and noting the recent testimony that we had with My House that the first and second sections of the bill pertain to unaccompanied youth where it is impossible to get in contact with the parents. So there are some provisions there to help address, different gaps in access. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. I did not offer an amendment for the section because I don't necessarily know how to fix it. And we brought it up in our last discussion about this particular bill, which is on page 4, lines 30 through 31. And this has to deal with the financial obligation where the parent or guardian of a minor is relieved of all financial obligations under this section. I don't know why that seems like that. That to me seems like it's going to create an unsustainable service of some sort. And I don't know. My initial thought in my notes here was to remove that section entirely, but then when I think about what that has as an outcome, I don't think that you can do that either. So I'm sort of just stuck with having that as just a giant question mark in here, which seems odd considering the breadth of the bill, that just those two lines are sort of the area that is a little sticky for me. But happy to hear the discussion on that. I know we talked about it already, but that's kind of where I'm coming to on that one.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I understand where Representative Ruffridge is coming from. I mean, I think, just to state the obvious, if you're going to have 5 visits with a counselor and not charge and not ask for permission from the parents, you can't send a bill to the parents because then you it sort of undermines the point of the bill. So I know I understand like why there's questions about that, and that feels like some sort of heavy burden. You know, it doesn't really spell out who the mental health provider is. I think there's no medications involved here. It's not a psychiatrist. It could be a social worker. It could be a school counselor. It could be, somebody who is at their day job, who this is part of their day job, and maybe doesn't have a heavy cost associated with it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, just a brief follow-up.
I think I'm sitting here thinking about my words for just a little longer, and I think the issue that I have overall is the bill is shifting a little bit of this idea between, to me, consent also implies a responsibility. And it's similar to other things that we give people of this age, sort of that in that gray area of entering adulthood but not quite there yet. you know, we allow them to have a driver's license that has some sort of parental component to it. And we certainly allow them to have some sort of a trial for crimes, potentially as an adult as well. But both of those things imply a responsibility. If you say that you can have this service, but then you're relieved of all obligation to pay for said service, it seems like that responsibility piece is missing. And that's, I think, where I'm not opposed at all to giving a 16-year-old some sense of moving into that, making decisions on your own and that adult sort of world. But I think it usually comes with responsibility, and that section removes it, and I'm concerned about that.
Part of how I've been thinking about this is, you know, if I'm just putting myself into the shoes of being a teenager, and if you're at that point where you want to talk through your problems and you are thinking about seeing a counselor, the first thing on your mind isn't going to be, oh, can I pay for this or can I cover it? I think the most important thing is trying to figure out how can you get to that point where you can talk to someone. I think having that ability to have a teenager get access to care as a first step is important. Knowing that any counseling service does cost time, but I think even just having that initial step is crucial, and that for the counselors who are providing these services, that, you know, they would figure out that financial responsibility. But, you know, I think in their minds that access is first and foremost the most important thing for that teen that might be in need. Rep Prox and then Rep Gray.
Yes, thank you. Question. It would seem to me that if there is a situation where the communication, I guess, has broken down so severely that children are not willing to communicate with their parents, and somebody else from the state, be it the school district or this counselor, I would think that triggers the mandatory reporting and that OCS would get involved. Is that, if this bill was not passed, is that still true that we would expect that OCS would get involved?
Representative Gray, did you want to respond?
Yes, I will respond. The answer is no. I would say I'll just quote from the National Center for Drug Abuse Statistics, 42% of teenagers in 12th grade have abused alcohol at some point. So 42% of seniors in high school have abused alcohol. I could see many examples where a kid might be drinking a lot and has a really good relationship with their parents, but doesn't want to tell them that they're drinking all the time, and maybe wants to, like, talk to a counselor about it. And in this case, I think what you'd say is like, well, I think they should tell their parents. Well, you know what that kid will say? Then I don't need to speak to a counselor. I don't need to speak to I'm good. Don't tell my parents. And I know that makes people real uncomfortable. They're like, you know what? Every parent needs to know everything about their 16 and 17 year old. But I'll just tell you, as a 16 and 17 year old who did lots of things without telling my parents, lots and lots of things, a lot of 16 and 17 year olds, it's going to be hard for some people to hear this. A lot of 16 and 17 year olds are not going to share everything with their parents. And this is a case where I think we could provide some help to a 16 or 17 year old that might prevent them from getting into a worse situation. And it is limited in scope. It's five. But I think if a child is a 16 or 17 year old is sneaking out and drinking alcohol, and then they tell the counselor that, OCS would not be involved.
Representative Prox?
Well, I understand and agree there are plenty of things that I did that I didn't want my parents to know about.
Like what? Just kidding.
I'll take the fifth on that one. And I can also think of, I don't know if I'd even say I got caught. I suppose I got caught. But the first step was get parents involved. And in retrospect, that was the right thing to do. I didn't think so at the time, but and we got stuff straightened out. So, I get the point, but I just am really uncomfortable with making it easier to exclude parents and keep them in the dark when they really should be involved.
Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand what we're trying to do here, and I want to thank the testifiers because I think that they brought up some really critical things that we should be considering here. This would be a very drastic change from the current model. I think it's two very separate things when we're talking about an unaccompanied youth, homeless youth, versus somebody that has a very involved parent or legal guardian. If we don't give parents and legal guardians the opportunity to be engaged, then we are usurping their authority as a parent. I'm concerned with some words that are in the bill. I'm seeing and hearing words used interchangeably that I don't think are interchangeable. Care, treatment, services, counseling. I think there's a lot going on there with those different terms. And I've also heard this is limited in scope, but I want to read the section that I'm very concerned with. It says, not later than the fifth appointment, and upon consultation with the minor, the mental health provider, in conjunction with the provider's supervisor, if the mental health provider has a supervisor, shall determine whether attempting to obtain consent of the minor's parent or guardian to provide behavioral or mental health services would be detrimental to the minor's well-being. Attempting to obtain the consent of the minor's parent or guardian would be detrimental to the minor's well-being if, and then it goes on to list some items. So again, this may not be temporary in nature, depending on the decisions made by the provider. So I am more than uncomfortable with the concept of completely bypassing a committed, a loving, engaged parent or guardian for these types of services. So I cannot support the bill as written, and there are just too many things in here that I just cannot support stepping away from that parent-child model. I think that is the best solution as a starting point, like Rep. Prox noted. As a teenager, I certainly would have been mortified had my parents been engaged in a conversation with me face to face on some things that I did or thought or said. But in the end, it would have been the right and proper decision. So,
Representative Fields.
Thanks. I don't think that acknowledging reality that not all families have great communication between parents or kids, or the reality that some parents are abusive, is endorsing that kids in healthy relationships not talk to their parents. Like, of course we continue to endorse that. We're also just acknowledging that we live in the real world and we should have behavioral health care for people in the real world. I think that's all the bill really does.
Representative Gray. Representative Mears and then Gray.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm kind of drawn back to our conversation on the floor last week about AI and social media and that discussion that we had. And I think we discussed it here in committee that, you know, kids that are seeking out help can seek it out online through chatbots that are not a real person, that are not going to give them good advice. I would much rather an older youth seek out a real person for these services than to go online, which is something that is readily available to them. I'll be supporting the bill.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, through the chair. We had a hearing in judiciary the Wednesday before last, which was with foster youth, sharing about the importance of sibling relationships. But what we heard over and over again was basically extraordinarily dysfunctional families that they were coming from. And so I think when you're comfortable with the first two sections of the bill, like, of course I want homeless youth to be able to access these services. What I would say is I think what the second part of the bill, the other sections of the bill are doing are preventing children, 16 and 17 year olds, from becoming homeless. Because we have lots, we heard the testimony in judiciary from 20 kids who essentially were, many of them were without a placement at age 16 or 17, were essentially homeless. And so I think what we're doing in the second half of the bill is giving those kids who are vulnerable the opportunity to access some mental health care when they might be made homeless if the parents are notified. But I guess, like, from some people's perspective, it's more comfortable if they access it after they're homeless. The second half of the bill is just sort of allowing them to access that care without becoming homeless. I think that's really the folks that we're trying to protect in the bill. But I can understand why people are uncomfortable with it. But it is only, again, you know, I'll say it again, 5 visits, no medications.
Representative Fields.
Thanks. Yeah, I just want to note, professional counselors are not going to encourage young people to kill themselves. You know, following up on Representative Muir's comment, parents have testified to Congress about their kids who had conversations with ChatGPT where ChatGPT not only encouraged the kids to kill themselves, ChatGPT offered to write their suicide note. So unfortunately, we're not in a world where it's either talk to a behavioral health professional without a parent or talk to a parent and then a behavioral health professional. The real world alternative is talk to an AI chatbot that may encourage a youth to kill themselves. And there was another case recently where, allegedly, Google Gemini, which is an AI bot, urged youth to commit suicide after committing mass murder. Like, literally, that's what AI encouraged them to do. So I'd rather have them talk to a professional, and I wish that all 16- and 17-year-olds, you know, had a conversation with their mom before going to bed every night about their feelings. But, like, that's not the real world. It just isn't.
Another perspective that I've just been thinking about as well is that I think there's a big shift in our next generation of youth where talking about mental health has just become a lot more normalized. And there are absolutely families, especially from different cultural communities, where that is a huge stigma to talk about. And I can totally imagine a teenager who wants to seek counseling services, and they ask their mom, and their mom is just mortified, and they treat what their child is saying as not something that's not real, that depression isn't real, that all these conditions aren't real. And I know that, you know, with my family, you know, first, they're all first-generation immigrants from Asia, that talking about mental health is just not a thing at all. And it is just heartbreaking to hear about those situations where a child wants to seek help and they can't get that. And so this would allow a little bit of that pathway where you can get to the point where a child is talking about their personal situation with their family, and they might already be doing that, but there's also another layer of seeking that professional help that you can get from a counselor. I did want to take a second. I know that we have Ms. Heather Ireland, who's still on the line with us, the executive director with the Anchorage School-Based Health Centers. Ms. Ireland, if you had any comments or any responses related to our discussion, please put yourself on the record.
I think Mr. Storrs spoke eloquently about the balance.
Ms. Ireland, please put yourself on the record. Excuse me, sorry.
Oh, sorry. This is Heather Ireland with Anchorage School-Based Health Center. I think Mr. Storrs with the Alaska Children's Trust spoke about how this bill is a good balance between giving 16 and 17-year-olds a small opportunity to access their own mental health care and then eventually involving their parents. And I think, you know, I just want to point out that, like, clinicians don't put ideas into youth's heads. They help them work through those ideas. And then this is the support that the students need is different than what their parents offer. It's not better or worse. It's just different. And some kids need that different support. So I think that this bill provides a bridge between helping kids navigate how do they talk to their parents about accessing mental health care. Because, you know, a lot of times youth will say, like, I can't tell my parent about this. And so, therefore, they can't go forward because they don't have parent consent. Whereas if this bill passes, then clinicians can work with youth on how do we communicate with your parents about the things that you're experiencing. So I think it's a good opportunity again, it's, you know, there's no medication involved. It's just helping them work through whatever it is that they've got going on and eventually involving their parents. To get them the preventative support that they need early on before it gets bad. So thank you for that, allowing me to comment on that.
Thank you, Ms. Ireland. Is there any further discussion from the committee? Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel like we're missing a really important part of this conversation. It is absolutely true. There are a lot of things that teenagers do not want to talk to their parents about. That has been a thing for eons. Okay, so the reality, though, is that this is not a binary choice between a behavioral health professional and a chatbot. I have served as a volunteer educator. I have served as a youth sports coach. I have served as a willing listener and parent of children that my friends or friends of my children. In general, there are lots of community members from youth groups to sports to churches to educators to the secretary at the school to you name it. There are so many other people in our children's lives that traditionally they have been able to talk to just sometimes get ideas out. And I think Mina's right when she says that I think the stigma around mental health is slowly fading. I think young kids now, they are more willing to talk about it, especially if they're feeling depressed or if they have suicidal thoughts. I'm not ready to let go of the fact that there is potentially a big network around every child throughout the day, throughout their community. And I just don't feel like stepping in front of a mental health provider that the parents don't know about, haven't chosen, haven't vetted, haven't talked to, is a good idea. I feel like a lot like when we choose our family care physicians, when we choose our, you know, any type of medical provider for our family, for our children, we want to be involved in those decisions. And I don't have any problem with behavioral health specialists or providers, but they are not all the same. And this bill just completely usurps a parent's right to make those decisions for their minor child. So I just... if there is a loving, like I said, if there is a guardian or a parent involved, they need to be engaged in this process before it starts, not after 5 90-minute visits or after 10 or a dozen if the behavioral health provider thinks that it's necessary. So I just, yeah, just put that out there.
Representative Box.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't get the answer that I expected, frankly, when I asked whether OCS should get involved if a situation like that is encountered. It surprised me. I took, well, I don't know if I did it all, but I passed the test, took the mandatory reporting training that was online, available online, and then passed the test. And frankly, when I got done with that, I said, well, I don't want to have anything to do with any organized children's anything, because there I'd be a mandatory provider. And before I knew that, a child could come up and talk to me. And now I have to think back quite a ways, but we could. When I was teaching at a school, a couple of different instances, a student came up and talked to me, and I taught algebra, and we didn't discuss algebra. And it could be done, and it could still be done if somebody well, there's a children's shelter in Fairbanks, and any youth that wants to can walk into that shelter, and somebody's going to talk to them. It can be done. I guess just by virtue of this law, this statute being there, it would further discourage me from getting involved and talking to someone. I would shun that because I'm not a licensed professional. So in that respect, I even think we're taking a step backward. Don't disagree that there's a problem, but we're not putting the right Band-Aid on the problem, covering up a problem. I honestly think we'd be better off doing nothing, just there are people that are available to talk, whether it's in a church or another group or whatever. If some child wanted to go get help from an adult, they can do that. Formalizing it, I think, is just unfortunately another step backward that's going to separate parents from children.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. I'd like to respond to Representative Schwanke and Representative Prox. I agree that lots of kids, especially 16 and 17-year-olds, may be connecting more with their theater teacher or their choir director or their football coach or their basketball coach than they are with their parents when they're 16 or 17. They might have that trusted adult in their life that they would ask for advice from in a way that they may not feel comfortable asking from their parents. I am just going to share very briefly, just personally, as somebody who grew up in a small town in Texas and was gay, I told three friends in high school, because I was not comfortable telling a single adult in that small town in Texas, not a single adult, because I was quite convinced that there was a good chance that they would tell my parents. And I don't know if my parents would have kicked me out in high school, but the fact that I'm unsure of it even today means, you know, I'm not going to tell them. I'm not going to talk about that with them. I mean, it's a very, you know, I was in a conservative, religious, small town community in Texas. So what I would say is that there are situations where a kid is smart enough not to trust any adults, because it could definitely turn their life upside down. And so the difference in this bill is, if you're seeing a licensed mental health professional and, you know, that there is that confidentiality, I can talk to you. And let me be clear, if this was the law in that town in Texas in 1993 or 92, whenever, I wouldn't have taken advantage of it, because I would have been too afraid that even that person would tell my parents. And so, I mean, I don't know. It's just like, I think I've been pretty honest. I think everybody knows that, like, this bill is a Senate bill. You know, I'm carrying it so that we have some discussion about it in the House. I wasn't, you know, it wasn't my idea. I really wasn't fully invested in it. But it means something. I think that there's I think people tend to see things through their own lens, and they think, well, I would never want my kid to see a therapist without me knowing it. And I appreciate that as a parent myself. I appreciate that. But there are kids who don't have you as a parent, and the options might be different for that kid.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, Chair Mina and the committee. I'm sitting here thinking, and I'm very grateful that I do feel like I have a good connection with my children, but I'm also grateful that there have been lots of folks in the community that have been good supports for them. But there's another perspective on that as well, in that not every adult that's making a bond and listening to a child has good intentions. And this is where pedophiles breed, you know, having trusted relationships with children and grooming them and taking advantage of them. And it's only 5 sessions, but having the option for someone that's in the schools already potentially that they can talk to and leaving the space for that, I'm there. And there's a lot to this. And I think the options that we have for opening this window a little bit is beneficial to our kids.
Representative Prox.
Difficult. I can think of 2 instances. In one case, and I was still in high school, a school counselor was just a hero to a bunch of friends that I met. They were going to, well, Maine school. It's not there anymore. Just a hero. I had never met the guy. I went to North Pole. And then, lo and behold, he got picked up for pedophilia, taking kids out camping and et cetera. It was ugly. And the same thing happened with another teacher not too long after that. It's been quite a while ago. Same deal. Somebody within the school district, a professional, if you will. Were they afraid to talk to their parents before they talked to him? I don't know. Too long ago. But this is by no means, in my experience, anywhere as close to a good solution.
Looks like we've gone through all of the discussion for the bill. Representative Gray, do you have any closing remarks?
No, thank you, Chair Mina.
Thank you, and thank you everyone for the discussion on the bill. I would now entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Chair Mina, I move House Bill 232, Work Order 34-LS1002/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached 0 fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 232 passes from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the committee report. Now, back on the record, now we are on our 3rd item on the agenda. We are back to House Bill 285 on the health information exchange by this committee. We have online available for questions Jason Ball, Chief Health Data Officer with the Department of Health. We also have Garrett Spargo, who is the board chair of Healthy Connect, and they administer the health information exchange. We'll move on to amendments. We received 1 amendment for House Bill 285. Representative Schwanke, would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move amendment number 1.
And I will object for the purposes of discussion.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mina. I simply wanted to step back and take a look at the health exchange from the perspective of somebody who is or has been previously unaware that their information exists in the health exchange. I believe that there are probably a lot of Alaskans that do not believe or know of this thing, and they have no idea that their personal health data exists within this health exchange. While there is an opt-out opportunity on the Health eConnect website, I'm guessing a whole lot of people don't even know that that exists. So in looking up some of this information for other states, I found that there are several states that do have opt-in language. California, Florida, Massachusetts, Nevada, New York, Vermont. Delaware recently shifted to an opt-in model. Some of the states have some pretty specific differences, such as mental health specifically might require an opt-in, even in a general opt-out state. I think there are some really good models out there that I would like to explore further with this particular piece of legislation, maybe even in a situation where in New York, there's an example. Affirmative consent is not required for certain emergency accesses or one-to-one exchanges. So I feel like there's a lot of information out there to be shared, and providers have a lot more say over what is shared. If you look at the Health eConnect website, some providers share certain information, not other information. I'm just quite concerned that there are a lot of Alaskans out there that don't understand that their information is already in the system, and I feel like we should be an opt-in state when it comes to the health exchange. That's my biggest question, which is why I put the amendment out. Welcome conversation on the topic.
Thank you, Representative Schwanke. Representative Gray, and then Prox.
Thank you. I think I have a question for whomever is online from Health eConnect. Through the chair, if we did this opt-in, in my experience as a provider in the urgent care, I often want to see the health problems and medications that the patient that I'm currently treating in front of me has. If this amendment were adopted and that patient in front of me said, I opt in, would I immediately have access to their chart?
I will go to Mr. Garrett Spargo, Board Chair of Health eConnect.
Hello, thank you. Yes, for the record, my name is Garrett Spargo. So if I heard the question correctly, you're asking if we switch to opt-in, would we have any access to see health problems, medications, and other relevant medical data? If we switch to the opt-in model, any patient that is not explicitly opted in, their information would not be visible through the system. So you would not see any of the information from other health organizations that may be treating that patient or have entered relevant medical data that's currently being shared in the opt-out model that we have.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
My follow-up would be, I can't support the amendment because I already struggle so hard to do my job with not being able to see patients' problem list and medication list, that if this went into effect and you know, the patient told their primary care, well, no, I don't want to opt in, and then they need, you know, Friday night at the urgent care, they're like, I don't know what my medicines are, which is 50% of the patients. It just, I mean, it's hard for me to exaggerate how hard it is to do your job when people don't know what medications they're on. I think I'll just state it, and Garrett can correct me if I'm wrong, but like when you access, you know, a provider's doesn't have unfettered access to the entire Health eConnect system. You are looking up a specific patient for a specific reason, which is that you are providing health care in that moment. So it's a very narrow criteria for accessing that chart. And so let's say you didn't know and your information was there. The only time anyone can look at it is when they're trying to provide healthcare to you. And I think it's an extremely small number of people who wouldn't want the provider to be able to see their information when they're providing the healthcare to them. Thank you.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. And I guess I would like to explicitly have that clarified, because I would expect if somebody had to opt in, probably even me, would say, nope, no thank you. But maybe 6 months or 2 years later, I would say, ooh, I sure wish I had. As I recall, and I would like to have somebody confirm or deny this explicitly, the only rational reason that I can think about that is I wouldn't necessarily want a potential employer or maybe an insurance provider to know that information. And as I recall, it's only accessible to care providers, but I would like to know for sure that it is only accessible to healthcare providers.
Mr. Sparger, could you help clarify on who accesses the HIE and what are the parameters of the information that they see when they use it?
Yes, thank you. This is Garrett Spargo. So this is correct. The patients that you are delivering care to, so that are kind of impaneled at your organization, you can only see and access the data for those patients. So you cannot go look up information for other patients who are not currently under your care. And this is aligned with other HIPAA regulations that are out there to help limit appropriate access to information. So you're only looking at that data that is available and that's appropriate for care and is not available elsewhere.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. So. Thank you. Through the chair, if the information is there, it can be gotten out somehow or t'other, I would expect. But then if that was traced back to whomever disclosed that information, they would somehow be civilly or maybe even criminally liable.
It sounds like that would be a violation of HIPAA for those providers, but Mr. Sparger, would you like to respond?
Yes, so there is, within the Health Information Exchange, extensive traceability and auditability. So the ability to determine if individuals have looked at information or attempted to look at information outside the appropriate scope of their practice would be captured. And so that is possible to look up, and that would indeed be a violation of law. I cannot speak to whether that is a criminal or civil claim, but it certainly would be a violation of the law. It would be subject to all the appropriate
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Gray?
Two quick things through the chair. So number one, when I have accessed not the HIE in particular, but shared medical exchanges between different hospitals, you literally you have to testify that under penalty of, you know, crimes and things, I have to access this chart. Like I have to click on that box and it says it to me every time that I am doing this because I have to. And so it's like a reminder every single time. But the second thing I wanted to point out, and Mr. Spargo can confirm it, but health insurance providers are not allowed to see this information either. So they can't check something that if you filled out a health insurance form and said you had no health problems, they cannot go look at this and see if you're telling the truth or not. Like it's that private. Like even the health insurance industry doesn't have access.
Mr. Spargo, could you respond?
Well, within acceptable use, that there is some accessibility to data for billing and payment purposes. I cannot speak to exactly where that boundary exists in terms of insurance providers or others. I could bring this to Kendra Stickey to respond to the committee to provide additional information if needed.
Thank you. I wanted to ask a question, Mr. Spargo. So Rep. Schwanke talked about the different states that have an opt-in model. My understanding is that the majority of states with their HIEs do have an opt-out model. So could you talk a little bit about what is the national standard for HIEs as it relates to opt-in versus opt-out?
Yes, absolutely, through the chair. So the majority of the states are indeed using the opt-out model. I don't have an exact count. I was trying to work with our vendor to establish the exact number. They were not able to provide it for me. They did provide other examples. For example, Rhode Island was initially an opt-in state. They have moved to an opt-out state. Some of the feedback from states like New York, which is an opt-in state, they've indicated that it took quite a few years before they had sufficient consent for the HIE to really begin delivering value. The administrative overhead that goes with that for the provider and for health organization does increase, and also adds some additional burden to patients to be able to find that process to opt in, share their data, and that extra complexity just introduces a barrier to data sharing that makes it more challenging. I would also like to point out that there is an important distinction here. The State Health Information Exchange, which Healthy Connect, we are the designated in that role, this language about opt-in or opt-out is pertinent to us. However, within a healthcare organization's privacy practices, and their notice of privacy practices, they may still choose to opt-in to some of the National Health Information Exchange utilities. So the two common ones in this space are Commonwealth and Care Quality. And so if the state were to move to a opt-in approach, that would limit our state government, a state-controlled HIE, it would limit our access to the data. But provider or healthcare provider organizations could still be sending that same data out to other large national groups. And so this would limit our ability while that data is still existing in these large national repositories.
Thank you, Mr. Spargo. Are there any other questions or comments from the committee? Mr. Representative Ruffridge, sorry.
Mr.
I could be Mr. too. That's fine.
Doctor.
Well, this is this is a good conversation. First of all, I'd like to say I really appreciate Representative Schwanke bringing this forward. One of the things this makes me think of quite a bit is the prescription drug monitoring program, which is mandated by law and accessed via an internet portal for persons who are dispensed controlled substances in this state and then now many other states. So if I am dispensing a controlled substance to an individual, I am mandated under law to look up their dispensing data both here and in a number of other states that we have linked to now. I have always felt and continue to feel that information, to Representative Schwanke's point, about that sharing of data should be a little bit more readily available. Most of my patients, when I talk to them about, this is information that's going to be shared and it's going to be on the cloud and that's mandated by law, most of them understand. They understand why. But there are a few that I think that's a point of contention for a lot of different reasons and concerns. I just, by my own nature, I think generally like to be asked the question of would you like to be in this program. I actually take a little bit of the opposite view of Representative Prox. If I'm asked to opt into a thing that might make something better, my general consensus on that is yes. And because I come from a place of thinking that my data is probably all out there anyway. So what am I trying to hide? But overall, I do believe that I think Alaskans in general, to Representative Schwanke's point, would actually be liked to they would like to know that they're opting into this thing. I think a lot of them actually would choose to opt into it for all the reasons that we've just discussed. I'm inclined to support this amendment for that reason. I think it actually helps us get information out about what this is and what it does and why it's important and why healthcare providers would like to be able to see things in an urgent care scenario. I think Representative Gray's point is well taken. Unfortunately, in reading through the statute in preparation for this, I don't see actually the main issue that you described earlier mentioned anywhere in the health information exchange, and that's medications. And I can say as a provider of medication services, we do not actually share health information unless it's to the PDMP. And so you would be getting that information through diagnosis or, you know, potential inclusion of choices made inside of someone's EHR, which does not indicate that they're filled necessarily either. So it's not a true indication of whether someone's taking that medication. All that being said, I think there's a lot of work to be done in this arena and a lot of questions to be asked. On amendment number one, I think this actually does help us get that work done if people are aware of what's happening and are opting into it, and they're opting into it for a purpose. So I'm going to support amendment number one.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge. I mean, we look up people's medication lists, not their controlled substances, all the time by seeing what they had filled through various pharmacy networks. So, I mean, I'm curious when you say, like, that information wouldn't be there. I mean, we see their non-controlled, you know, their levothyroxine. We see it, in, you know, at CVS Caremark, like, it comes up. So I'm curious about saying that you don't share it when we can see it.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, through the chair. So large-scale entities who have a national presence and who have, under other requirements, been required to apply a health information exchange, they're required, because they're required to do it nationally, do share data. So CVS Caremark is a really good example. Probably another thing that we need to talk about the difference between national standard and state standard. Under our state standards right now, a pharmacy is exempted from all of these requirements.
A follow-up, Rep. Gray.
Thank you. I'll follow up with Mr. Spargo. So because I've actually never accessed the HIE, all of my – what I'm talking about all the time is when you work at the VA, you can access everyone's records. If I want to see their DOD, I have to break the glass. And so I've been kind of using that as an example of getting onto this thing, is that it's the equivalent of me at the VA going to look at someone's DOD record, which requires me to say that I'm only doing this because I'm providing healthcare to the person in front of me. But Mr. Spargo, on our health information exchange, are we able to see, like, as are medical providers able to see someone's medication list?
Mr. Spargo?
Yes, so this is Garrett Spargo for the record. So medication data is available through the HIE, kind of a typical PAMI problem, allergy, medication, immunization data is available. I cannot speak concretely as to whether we see all the details in terms of prescription fills and whether they are being compliant or utilizing the medication. That information as a part of the record is transmitted through the HIE.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion from the committee? Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, to Rep. Ruffridge, I want to make sure I understood what you were talking about. If I understood what you were saying, requiring people to opt in gives you the opportunity to explain why and that they would normally opt in.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mina. Yes, in my experience, when you tell people the purpose of the thing and why it helps them in the long run, that is a thing that people generally are supportive of. If you hide the thing and say, this is happening without your knowledge, then people think you're up to no good. That's just my experience.
Good point. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gray?
Sorry, this will be my last comment, Madam Chair. I just think I want to be able to provide the best health care that I can to a patient. I want to be able to know exactly what's wrong with them, exactly what they're taking, so that I can do my best job. And maybe most people will opt in, But I'm just saying Murphy's Law is that half my patients will not have opted in. And so basically this amendment would prevent me from being able to provide the best health care in the moment. My fear is that I won't be able to give somebody the best health care that they deserve if I don't have access to their chart. And so I appreciate where the amendment's coming from. It is Alaska. We love our privacy. But it is protected. To speak to, you know, Representative Prox's comments, if somebody was using this in a nefarious way, it is criminal. It is criminal. And it is easily traceable, and we know who did it, and they would get in trouble. And so I think we have the protection. You know, it's for a very specific purpose so that the person can receive the best health care possible. Thank you.
Representative Prox.
Oh, thank you. Now, through the chair to Rep. Gray. I'm confused the other way. So if I had not opted in the first place, if I'm understanding what you're saying, the information is there. It's just that at the moment that it's needed, somebody couldn't access it, which seems really weird.
Through the chair.
Representative Gray.
Well, Mr. Spargo said that if you didn't opt in, then it wouldn't be in the health. So the health information exchange is sort of like this thing out here. And if a particular system is using it, then they're sharing their data with that. If a patient told their primary care doctor, I don't want my information shared with the HIE, then it wouldn't be shared. Okay. So when I see you in urgent care, I can't see it because it's not there. And what my very first question was, like, in real time, could I say, hey, he's opting in now? No, because it was never shared from your clinic.
Okay. I have a question for Mr. Spargo. Just understanding, like, how this works operationally. So, I mean, in a different life, I worked briefly as a pediatric receptionist, and I remember handing out those different patient privacy forms to folks. So, does the opt-out language, would it just be on all of the patient privacy forms that patients are going to sign anyway, Mr. Spargo?
Yes, through the chair, yes. The opt-out information should be a part of the notice of privacy practices. Now, every healthcare organization and provider can choose which information appears in it. We do require that they communicate this information through their form. We don't dictate the language, but we do provide sample language that should be used to both explain how the data is being used and also how to opt out.
Thank you, Mr. Spargo. I am going to maintain my objection. I do appreciate the amendment and also the discussion about making sure that patients are aware of their privacy related to their data. I think what we currently have with the patient privacy forms, the notice of privacy practices, is that I would want those patients to be attentive when they are signing those forms and know that they can opt out of the HIE. I do think that there is validity in helping to inform patients of what the HIE is, and I would hope that every provider is as excellent as Dr. Ruffridge and that provider talks to their patient about this data, but I don't know that in practice, and I do have some concerns hearing from New York that it took them a couple of years for their HIE to be helpful, given that they're a huge state that has a lot of people, and you would think that they would have that data pretty fast. So I'm going to maintain my objection. Would the secretary please call?
Can I respond?
Oh, sure. Representative Schwanke.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond to some of the comments that were made. I was just taking some notes. So there's quite a few things that were hit on. I do appreciate the conversation around the prescriptions of controlled substances because I think that that is kind of a standalone issue that highlighted the importance of a certain type of health care data. And why it needed to be shared. Now, a couple different things. I heard a question, is opt-out language on intake forms? We
specifically pulled intake form for Providence, and 4 pages. There's no opt-out language in there. There's no box that you check. There's no information. It just says we are a network provider within a health exchange. And I don't know how many people read all 4 pages, and then they go ahead and sign it. So I'm very uncomfortable with the fact that there is no specific provided language by this, you know, by the exchange. It might be something to consider. I know also on the opt-out page, we specifically looked at the language there, and if you have a couple key pieces of information about an individual, which you may have about your spouse, you can opt them out. There is no requirement on the page for that individual to be notified that they have been opted out. So I have recommended that also to the Healthy Connect individuals. I think that's inappropriate. There was a comment about you get in trouble if you use the data inappropriately. Well, I've had personal experiences where there were very obvious HIPAA violations where information was shared, especially in small communities. So, and nobody got in trouble. And this has happened over and over and over. So, yes, we've all had our information breached in some way, shape, or form in different databases. So there is some serious still concern about data in an otherwise secure network. I know through personal experiences that there are private HIEs that you can join, you can pay for, that does allow you to put all your personal information in one space. You can easily provide that to a provider when you step in to an appointment or hospital, or if you have an advocate, if you come in the ER. So those are a thing, and that is a way for people to have all of their health information in one spot. If you don't do that, otherwise you walk in, you end up filling out a form for a one-to-one exchange from your past provider. So, hey, I want my information transferred to this hospital today, because there's a serious issue. I want to read a couple things from, so the New York Health Info Network, it says their content is categorized into levels. Level one, treatment, care management, quality improvement, and level two, other uses like research or payer reviews, with required elements including categories of information, intended uses, and expiration for level two data. And then in Nevada, they have some interesting language that makes me wonder if our provider locally, the HIE, has some more flexibility that we're not talking about. And their specific statutes and regulations require informed consent opt-in before retrieving or accessing patient health information from an HIE. It specifically states consent must be obtained before retrieval, and patients can refuse or revoke it. So it makes me think in some of these other states in these opt-in situations where there is the data contained in the health exchange, and the minute that a patient comes in, say, to an ER, that there can be approval, consent given right there at that moment in time. And I don't know if our individual Alaska HIE can do that, but it is being done in other states. Again, I really hope that we have an opportunity to continue talking about this, because in the end, this really comes down to a question. Is the desire of a provider to have all available data at every appointment or visit, does that trump an Alaskan's right to control their access to their own data? And I don't think it does. I totally recognize the desire of a healthcare provider to have all available information. That's your job. That's what you're tasked to do, is to provide the best possible care at that moment in time. And however, I feel like the statute on this particular issue really does need a lot of additional work and discussion to make it work just much more effectively and efficiently, while protecting personal rights, while at the same time allowing that opportunity for providers to have all appropriate information quickly. So, anyways, thank you for the really good conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Schwanke. My apologies for jumping the ball there. I know that the next committee of referral for this bill heads to Labor and Commerce, and we have some crossover members of this committee with that committee. And so I would hope that Labor and Commerce would take another look at that balance between patient privacy and ensuring that we also ensure the maximum utility of the HIA for our healthcare system. Before I close discussion on this, I know we had Jason Ball, Chief Health Data Officer with the Department of Health, on the line. I was wondering if you just had any additional perspectives or any response to the discussion on this amendment related to the opt-down versus opt-out versus opt-in language for the HIE. Mr. Ball?
Sure. Good afternoon. For the record, Jason Ball, Chief Health Data Officer with the Department of Health. Appreciate the robust discussion here. And regarding opt-in and opt-out, I would absolutely expect decreased participation and a hampering of medical providers' ability to perform some of the essential work that they do in the context of the opt-in versus the opt-out provision. We see that nationally with other states. As I interface with my peers in other states, that's some of the same messaging that we get from them. And I think I'll leave my comments there.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. All right. I will maintain my objection. Would the secretary please call the roll?
Thank you. On the current committee substitution.
For amendment number one.
For amendment number one, Representative Prox?
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge?
Yes.
Representative Schwanke?
Yes.
Representative Mears?
No.
Representative Fields?
No.
Representative Gray?
No.
Representative Mina?
No.
All right. The yeas are 3, the nays are 4.
Seeing that, amendment number 1 is now adopted.
No.
It did not. It was not 3 adopted. To 4. Not
oh, is that
adopted.
Not what I said? Amendment number 1 is not adopted.
Correct.
Yes. Thank you. Let me restate that one more time. On a vote of 3 yeas to 4 nays, amendment number 1 is not adopted. Brief eddies. Back on the record, we will now open up the bill for public testimony. First off, is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online who wishes to testify? Seeing no more individuals wishing to testify, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Is there any further discussion on House Bill 285? Seeing none, I would now entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Chair Mina, I move House Bill 285, Work Order 34-LS1177/in-as-in-November, from committee with individual recommendations and attached 0 fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 285 passes from committee. We'll take a brief eddies to send the committee report. Agenda today, House Bill 292, Pediatric Autoimmune Neuropsychiatric Disorders. This will be the initial hearing on this bill by Representative Colombe on this disorder. Would Representative Colombe and staff, Emily Scabhog, please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
So good afternoon, Chair Mina and the members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Julie Colombe, District 11, serving South Anchorage Hillside.
For the record, I am Emily Scabhog, staff to Representative Julie Colombe.
So I'm honored to introduce HB 292. After recently hearing from one of my constituents, She talked me through her family's journey with PANDAS, pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder associated with strep infections, and PANS, pediatric acute onset neuropsychiatric syndrome, and their fight with the insurance companies, who denied medically necessary care. She and the team of advocates who met with me asked for my help to ensure Alaska's children who need this care would not be left behind. So HB 292 proposes that insurance covers this care. And I think the committee remembers last year we did the big proclamation of PANS and PANDAS. And so I know you're probably a little familiar with it, but we do have invited testimony to kind of explain the situation.
Great. We will turn to our invited testifiers today. First, I will invite Sarah Lemley, Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Northwest PANDAS / PANS Network. If you could please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Okay. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Wonderful. Okay. Chair Mina and members of the Health Committee, my name is Sarah Lemley, and I am the Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Northwest Panda PANS Network, a 501c3 nonprofit that serves Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska. But more importantly, I'm the mother of a child who had PANDAS. If you've never heard of PANDAS and PANS before, you aren't alone. Discovered in the late 90s by Dr. Susan Sweeto at the National Institute of Mental Health, the first publication appeared in 1998 in the American Journal of Psychiatry. PANDAS and PANS occur after an infection, most commonly a strep infection. PANS, however, can be triggered by other infections such as Mycoplasma pneumonia, the herpes virus, and COVID. These children have a misdirected immune response, which results in brain inflammation. An affected child generally has an abrupt onset of obsessive compulsive disorder, restricted eating, tics or other abnormal movements, anxiety, personality changes, decline in math and handwriting abilities, sensory sensitivities, rage, suicidal ideation, and more. Many families can name the exact date that onset occurred, and most ask, "What happened to my child?" Diagnostic guidelines were published in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology in 2015 by the PANS Consortium of Physicians and Researchers. Treatment guidelines came next in 2017, and treatment for these disorders is based on severity. Mild cases may only need antibiotics or anti-inflammatories or steroids. More severe cases may need higher line treatment, such as intravenous immunoglobulin or plasma exchange. But it is estimated that only 10 to 20% of those with these disorders will need the higher line treatments, such as IVIG. IVIG has well-established anti-inflammatory and immunomodulatory properties. The benefits of using IVIG for PANDAS and PANS have been rigorously examined since 2015, most recently in a placebo, phase 3 placebo-controlled study. But for most people, treatments like IVIG are inaccessible without insurance coverage. One round of IVIG out of pocket can cost tens of thousands of dollars. We are here today to get your help in ensuring all insurers provide coverage for IVIG. When insurers deny coverage, which they often do, providers become frustrated with the lengthy appeal process. Their time is taken away from patient care to instead fight for treatment that their patient needs. Some providers will even refuse to even bring it up to a family as an option, knowing that insurance will likely deny coverage. More importantly, the denial appeal process prolongs the child's suffering and the family's trauma. These denials increase the risk of serious neurological and psychological harm, long-term disability, or even loss of life. Many families go to great lengths to try to pay privately when insurance denies coverage. We've had families who have sold their homes, they've depleted their retirement savings, or their crowdfunding on social media. Imagine as a parent watching your child deteriorate before your eyes, losing parts of their childhood they will never get back, knowing that there is a medical treatment that could alleviate their symptoms and allow them to return to their baseline. This is what Panda PANS parents are forced to do when insurance companies withhold medically necessary treatment. HB 292 plays a critical role in addressing these long-standing gaps in awareness, diagnosis, and care. Governor Dunleavy formally recognized pandas and pans in 2025 with his rare disorder proclamation, calling out the need for better treatment options while acknowledging coverage issues. 15 other states have passed this legislation. Bipartisan support has shown how these disorders impact every community. Consensus among policymakers, clinicians, and families demonstrate that these conditions warrant serious attention, coordination, and timely action. Those who require IVIG are the sickest, most debilitated children. Their lives are literally on the line, and we need your help. To only have this life-saving treatment available to those who are affluent enough to pay privately is a health inequity we must address. Alaska kids matter, all of them. All of them should have the chance to heal, to recover, and to restore the childhood that Pandas and Pants has stolen from them. I urge you to prioritize this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lumley, for your testimony. Next, we have Rebecca Pullins. If you could please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, Chair Mina and members of the House Health and Social Services Committee, for the record, my name is Rebecca Pullins. I live in Anchorage, South Anchorage, and I'm a constituent of Representative Coulomb. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I want to thank my representative for sponsoring this bill. In March of 2023, my son Finley celebrated his 7th birthday by going golfing with his friends. He loved to play with his little sister, and he loved school. He was a typical boy, meeting all milestones and behaving in age-appropriate ways. Just over a month later, that happy boy disappeared into himself. On April 30th, 2023, with no warning and no previous indication of anxiety, Finley was intensely afraid of our home. That was a Sunday. On Monday, he cried and told me he didn't want to go to school. On Thursday, he was afraid to touch the remote in fear that it would control people. He put 4 fingers in his mouth to self-soothe, something I hadn't seen since he was a toddler. That night at bedtime, he cried for me. He couldn't stop imagining getting run over by a car while riding his bike. 1 month later, he couldn't play with his sister, couldn't eat without being terrified of the color yellow and tapping his dishes the right number of times in just the right way. He couldn't move through our house without a compulsive ritual between rooms. He avoided some areas completely. Getting dressed each day took at least half an hour. Every waking moment for him was agony, as each part of his day made him feel deathly afraid. He had violent meltdowns, kicking, screaming, and even biting. Then he would dissolve into tears and apologize repeatedly. We knew it wasn't him. The terror in his eyes told us that he was not in control. On June 1st, just over a month after onset, Finley was diagnosed with PANDAS through a positive strep test and started medical treatment with anti-inflammatories and antibiotics. Within days, he was playing with his sister again. Suddenly, the OCD started to melt away. His first laugh after starting treatment brought much needed hope. I need you to understand how quickly this illness progresses, the damage it does, and just how lucky my family is. My son's health rapidly deteriorated in just 1 month. Current estimates suggest it takes the average family more than 2 years to receive a proper diagnosis. In that time, PANS and PANDAS does potentially permanent and life-threatening damage. As a result, many of those children will need advanced treatment. If it had taken that long for my family to receive the proper diagnosis, my son very likely would have been one of those children that needed advanced treatment. IVIG is the gold standard treatment for PANS and PANDAS, but it is cost prohibitive for most of us because most insurance companies deny coverage. Without it, many children will end up in psychiatric care, the juvenile system, or suicidal. Children are losing their lives. 15 other states have already passed similar bills. Our kids are the future. IVIG is the future for these kids. Please support this bill so that the children of Alaska have access to the proper treatments. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pullins, for your testimony and for sharing your story. Lastly, we have Michelle Hayworth. Could you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Hello, my name is Michelle Hayworth. Thank you, Chair Mina and members of the Healthcare Committee. I currently live in East Anchorage, and I'm a constituent of Representative Gray. I've lived in Alaska for over 20 years. I was Representative Field's constituent when he got elected in Government Hill. Both of my children were born here. I want to thank Representative Colomb for bringing this bill to the House and you all for this time. It means a lot to be able to tell our story. In January of 2025, my 14-year-old son was taken to McLaughlin Youth Center in Anchorage after a terrifying escalation of behaviors. In the traumatic silence that followed these devastating events, I learned about pandas and autoimmune inflammation of the brain triggered by infection. Juvenile detention was the only option available to us at that time. My son wasn't a criminal. He hadn't gone through any acute trauma or been neglected or abused. He was a child experiencing severe brain inflammation, but no one knew that yet. For years, we had searched for answers. We saw specialists, therapists, neurologists, psychiatrists, Medicaid-funded allergy workups, gastrointestinal care, neuropsychological evaluations, crisis response calls, emergency room visits, even police and fire department calls resulting in psychiatric holds. Still, no one recognized the pattern, recurring autoimmune inflammation attacking his brain. By the time he was admitted to McLaughlin Youth Center, he had accumulated a list of diagnoses, but none that had actually addressed the cause of his symptoms. There had been dramatic ups and downs to this point, but overall, there was less and less of my kind, creative, persistent, extremely bright boy left in his personality. My son has an IQ over 140, yet here he was, unable to function. Even basic hygiene had become a challenge, and I was looking to those in memory care for tools to deal with the level of irrational, developmentally inappropriate meltdowns that had started happening more and more frequently as time went on. When he was released 4 days after admission to McLaughlin Youth Center, we started him on maximum dose, around-the-clock ibuprofen. Within 72 hours, the violent, irrational aggression was gone, completely gone. 2 more months passed before we could access knowledgeable pandas care in Alaska. When our medical provider ran comprehensive labs, almost everything was abnormal. Inflammatory markers, autoimmune indicators, serious hormone and endocrine disruption, infectious titers, mold exposure, nutrient deficiencies, and more. Looking back, his onset likely began when he was a toddler, meaning for 10 plus years, my child was misdiagnosed. None of the dozens of health professionals we'd seen had ever checked the status of these indicators. It took more than a decade to find treatment. It's really hard to adequately express the type of trauma and injustice this experience inflicts on a whole family. The cost financially and emotionally is staggering. I hold a master's degree from a top-rated university, yet can only work a flexible, low-wage job because of my children's care needs. We rely on Medicaid for healthcare, subsidized housing, and food assistance. The financial cost to our family and to the state of Alaska in the last decade likely approaches $500,000 for care that wasn't addressing the real problem. Months after my son's diagnosis, my daughter began suddenly confessing imagined wrongdoings, describing intrusive thoughts, her pupils dilated. Because I now understood PANS and PANDAS, I recognized the behavior immediately. We treated her with anti-inflammatories within days of onset. Her symptoms resolved in less than 24 hours. Early recognition and treatment changed her life. She will likely never see a psychiatric emergency room or juvenile detention facility. We are not the only family in Alaska experiencing this devastating condition. I don't know if Sarah mentioned it. The conservative estimates right now are about 1 in 200. That means we have probably around 1,000 kids in Alaska with this condition, and I know of less than 100. If you're looking for answers as to why Alaska has such a big mental health crisis for youth, we have brought you a significant piece of the puzzle today. Insurers and Medicaid can keep paying for inappropriate therapies and treatments, crisis calls, emergency rooms, police response, detention, and even the death of these Alaskan children. Or we can recognize and treat this disease with the urgency it requires. We need every evidence-based treatment for PANS and PANDAS to be available for our kids before it's too late, before it progresses, before a whole family is traumatized, before we all pay the costs of not treating it, before these kids receive treatment that is ineffective at best and outright harmful at worst, before these kids commit suicide. The language of HB 292 currently does not require Medicaid coverage. According to the 2024 statistics I could find, 57% of Alaska's children rely on Medicaid for health coverage. I'd ask that you reconsider this so my child and others aren't left out. Please support HB 292 so all Alaskan children can have access to treatment, including and especially those on Medicaid.
Thank you.
That's all I've got.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hayworth, for your testimony, and thank you for sharing your story. And I really appreciate all of our testifiers today for just expressing all of the experiences they've had with this situation. Do we have any questions for our invited testifiers? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to say to Ms. Pullins and Ms. Hayworth, thank you so much for sharing your personal stories. I'm so sorry for what you've been through with your families.
Thank you. I know that we also have a presentation related to the bill. I'm going to switch back to Representative Colomb and her staff to go through that presentation. I do want to note for time, we're at 5:09 p.m., so we have a couple minutes left in the committee, but I think we can get through this area.
Yeah, it's a short presentation. It's just a couple pages.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Mina. For the record, again, my name is Emily Skovhog, staff to Representative Julie Colomb. HB 292 proposes insurance coverage for PANDAS and PANS. These are pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders associated with streptococcal infections, also known as PANDAS, and pediatric acute onset neuropsychiatric syndrome, also known as PANS. Both of these disorders result in inflammation in a child's brain from immune system dysregulation, causing life-altering symptoms. Up until recent years, insurance companies have had lack of billing codes, ICD-10 codes to be specific, as far as up until October of 2020, for which PANDAS now falls under. However, this is still only potentially covering first-line defenses for children and families, not treatments thereafter. HB 292 proposes insurance coverage, treatments like, as previously discussed by our invited testifiers, IVIG, which is also known as intravenous immunoglobulin therapy, which is proven for overall positive long-term impact of treatment on a child's life, including behavior, cognition, and physical health, which currently costs families for each session of treatment on the low end tens of thousands of dollars out of their own pockets. HB 292 puts into state law that insurance companies must cover the costs of these life-changing treatments. If the committee has any questions, we would be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to the sponsor and her staff. I'm just curious if at the next hearing, if we could have a medical doctor speak about the studies that have been done and about the treatments available.
We can definitely do that. Thank you.
Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I guess we need to clarify, is apparently now the diagnosis is established, and forgive me, I don't know anything about this. But apparently what I understood was the diagnosis is established, and then is the lack of insurance coverage driving towards misdiagnosis? I didn't quite follow how that worked, because there was one, it seemed to me there was apparently a quick diagnosis and then a fairly mild treatment. And then in other cases that they were talking about, that a long time to figure out the diagnosis. But I'm trying to figure out if it's a question of whether the diagnosis is recognized, or is it so new that it is medical training or something like that is causing the misdiagnosis.
To respond to that?
It looks like Ms. Lemley dropped off, so we only have Heather Carpenter with the division. Okay. They're all here. Oh. Never mind. That was misinformation. Ms. Lemley, could you respond to Representative Prox's question?
Hi. Can you clarify again what your question is? I want to answer it in the right way.
What I was understanding from the testimony was that in some cases there was a fairly quick diagnosis and a rapid treatment. Yep. I think they said just ibuprofen or something. And then other cases, it took a long time to diagnose the problem, and therefore you needed, I can't remember the medical name of something, but it is very expensive.
Was it
the fact that it might not be covered wasted a lot of time trying to figure out something else that could be covered? I suppose that's the question.
Ms. Lemley?
So Ms. Lemley with Northwest Panda Pans Network. So first of all, just to remind the committee that these disorders are on a spectrum and they can present as mild, moderate, and severe. So different severity requires different treatment. In Rebecca's case, her child was diagnosed very quickly and had first-line treatments with anti-inflammatories and I believe antibiotics as well, which resolved symptoms. But unfortunately for many children, there is a lack of awareness within all of our communities, including even within our medical communities. And there are many factors for that, which I would love to get into more detail maybe at the next hearing. But that is why some of these kids the provider won't even consider that it's pandas and pans, maybe because they're not aware of it or they're not up to date on the research or the diagnostic and treatment guidelines. And so many of these kids, as Michelle's child did, get a host of psychiatric diagnoses because that's how the symptoms present. And then they get treated as psychiatric cases when in fact the symptoms are being driven by a medical cause, which is brain inflammation. Mm-hmm. And so it's ineffective treatment for a number of years.
Okay,
quick follow-up?
Yep. Yeah, we're trying to change something on the insurance end, but it almost sounds like there's, and I don't know that we have any control over the medical end. People don't know, or insurance companies don't know, I'm not sure. But I'm wondering if we're trying to address the correct law. I don't know if there is a law other than insurance that we have control over. But we might
I think that's
I'm concerned
question.
That we're doing the wrong thing.
Ms. Lemley?
Yeah, and so that is what our nonprofit is working to do in the state of Alaska, is raise awareness within our communities. And so we're already doing that work. We're presenting at the Nurse Practitioner Conference in April on pandas and pans, and we're working with the school district. We just gave a presentation to North Slope School District last week. So we're doing our bit to raise awareness, but with raising awareness, you're going to have a ton of kids who are going to be diagnosed and who are going to need treatment. And one of those treatments that we're talking about, this intravenous immunoglobulin, is denied by most insurance companies.
And one last follow-up?
One last, I'm sorry, but and this intravenous treatment is the one that is so expensive that that's why the insurance companies, our coverage is required. But if it's treated earlier, is there a less expensive treatment?
Ms. Lemley?
Yes. So early diagnosis and intervention with treatment leads to better outcomes and the need to not necessarily advance to intravenous immunoglobulin. I will mention that four states, California, Virginia, Massachusetts, and Nebraska, all have done separate fiscal analyses and have found that the inclusion of that IVIG coverage for insurance companies only raises premiums to members by pennies a month, whereas the long-term effect and benefit of getting that IVIG to that child is life-changing. And so that's what we're looking to Alaska to consider as well.
I'm sorry, one more. So it, okay, it sounds, through the chair, it sounds like a win-win for cost of insurance and also life saved, life improved.
Okay. Good. I see a nod from Ms. Lemley. Wonderful. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Rep. Ruffridge?
Thank you, Chair Mina. My question, when the IVIG is denied, is there a standard denial that is sent? And if so, what are they denying it for?
Ms. Lemley?
So the insurance companies that are denying coverage will typically claim investigational or experimental because it is used off-label, even though one in three medications are used off-label. And we also prescribe SSRIs to children that have a black box warning. But those are the reasons they deny.
Follow up.
Thank you. So the denial is that it's an investigative use. Are these medications going through a prior authorization process and then that's what is being done, including like notes from physicians and things?
Ms. Lemley?
Correct, for the insurance that deny IVIG, but I will note not all insurance companies do deny. There are some. So, for example, Aetna, one of the biggest national providers of insurance, recently updated their policy bulletin to include coverage for IVIG. And so we have this inequity across insurance companies on who is paying for it and who isn't and the reasons given for denial.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from committee? All right, seeing none, we will set aside House Bill 292. Thank you to Representative Colomb and her staff for presenting today. I'm setting an amendment deadline for House Bill 292 for next Monday, March 9th at 12 p.m. The next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Standing Committee will be Tuesday, March 10th at 3:15 p.m. The time is 5:20 p.m., and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.